Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm glad to have you with us today. We're going to be following the money as per usual with one of our favorite guests, Alan Roth. He is a columnist, financial planner, a columnist for AARP, and has written for the Wall Street Journal. And is it CBS Money Watch, Alan?
Yeah, I'm writing for the Wall Street Journal now, not CBS.
Very good. Watch. Okay. But been there, done that. And in fact, you and your theory are the subject of my column today, the Federal Report. And something I wanted to quote from it, because you were ahead of the pack on this. In today's column, you're talking about, we were talking about the impact, if any, of the bombings in Belgium and Paris. And you recall that the horrific Paris attack last November, you said the U.S. stock market responded the following week by gaining 3.3%, which I think was the single best week in the stock market in 2016. International stocks also rose 2.7% that week. The conclusion isn't that the market likes terrorism. It's that other events and even random movements of a very complex system known as the stock market are hard to explain and even harder to forecast. So that I think that would surprise a lot of people, although it's interesting that's mentioned twice today in the Washington Post in different columns.
Yeah, we all want to be able to explain, you know, why the stock market does what it does.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of headlines are basically garbage. Again, in the Paris attacks, it happened on a Friday night. And how did the market react? It went up. That was a very hard week for market headline writers.
Yeah, and I noticed, too, they always interpret it as the market felt this or the market, as if it was a living creature that that ran away when Janet Yellen spoke or something like that.
Yeah, or sellers take charge. You know, for every seller, there happens to be a buyer in the market.
There you go. Good point. Let's get some of these questions out of the way. People have been emailing us questions. And by the way, our number here is 202-465-3081. That's 202-465-3081. 3081. And here's one from Michael in Arlington. And he says, Mr. Roth, is there a reliable service that TSP investors can use to alert them to potential market moves for the S and I funds? TSP investors have to make decisions to move assets from one fund to another by noon Eastern Standard Time in order for it to take effect at close of business that day. For example, if I chose to move my S fund, S&P 500 assets, into the safer, if less rewarding, G fund, government securities, to avoid a 40% correction, it would be nice to have access to some informed market forecasts that looked out 3, 5, 30, and 180 days, showing market trends and risks. The TSP doesn't offer this, and the noon cutoff places the plan participants at a disadvantage with others in the market. Sure glad you're here to answer that one.
Yeah. I would agree that it would be nice to have such a reliable forecaster. With that said, if I knew of one, I wouldn't tell everyone about it. And, you know, common sense is not all that common. If somebody really knew what the market was going to do in the next 3, 5, 30, or 180 days, they'd have infinite wealth, you know, advising $100 billion institutions, not writing a newsletter about it and trying to sell it for $299 a year. So, no, there isn't. Number two, the more you move funds, there's been just a ton of studies shown, the more you're going to time the market very poorly.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess everybody has anecdotal stories, but I literally have a close friend who we worked together and our portfolios were almost identical. And he was an accounting type and he tracked them. And he got onto a system. I think he went to Toronto and took a course, a week-long course or something, came back, bought some machinery, bought some software. And bottom line is he was day trading and he lost literally every penny. So there's nobody out there, no magic guru, right?
Yeah, there isn't. And again, a ton of studies, you know, show that the more you move funds, the more you underperform. And the one reliable long run market timing that works is called rebalancing.
Mm-hmm.
So when stocks go down, you have to buy more because the herd will be selling. I can't predict the market, but I can predict something almost as powerful, that people will buy high and sell low, fear and greed.
Yeah, and virtually everybody knows that, and yet we continue to do what we do. We sell low and buy high. here's a, I guess this is more of a comment than a question. It says when they leave government, whether to take another job or retire, about half of all TSP investors roll their thrift savings plan account over into another outside IRA. Some say they do it because it's more convenient. Others believe they'll have more investment options. Do you have any advice for them?
Don't do it. I wish I could get in.
Okay.
It is the best 401k type plan in the country.
Period. End of story. Huh?
Period. Okay. End of story. I wish I were in. I've made this joke a couple of times. Somebody hire me.
Yeah.
For pay me $1. Let me move my IRA money into the thrift savings plan and then fire me.
Dollar a year, man. Right. Okay. Here's one. The TSP says it has the lowest fees in the business, even below Vanguard's. So how important are fees? Are they that big a deal?
Yes, they're huge. Over time, you know, the power of compounding makes a huge difference versus an average fund with, let's say, a 1% expense ratio or something low like Vanguard or something even lower like the thrift savings plan, which you're not paying my industry, you're getting in the way of return.
Okay, so good, very important, and we, you know, we always think of compounding as growth, but compounding also works the other direction too. It can take away.
Yeah, because you have lower fees, there's higher growth, and then the higher growth means higher return over time.
Okay, here we go. This is what it says. The TSP has so-called life cycle funds. The idea is you invest in the one closest to the date when you'll start withdrawing money from your account. For many people in government, that is years after the date they actually retire. How do life cycle funds work, and are you a fan of them? And if so, is there anybody who should stay away from them? And I guess when you mentioned about rebalancing, that's key to this, huh?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of life cycle funds. I don't use a life cycle or target date retirement fund, and I'll explain why. But, you know, one of the sins, it happens to be... I'm blanking out.
I have your list of seven. Optimism, consumerism.
I'm sorry. Yeah, what the thrift savings plan, it'll do the rebalancing for you in the life cycle funds. It harnesses inertia, which is the most powerful force in the universe. So it will, you know, buy stocks when stocks have gone down and sell when they've gone up. So it's a wonderful thing. I'm a big fan of them. The reason why I don't use them is that asset location is important. I've always said investing is simple. I've never said taxes were.
Uh-huh.
So you're better off putting the fixed income in the tax-deferred IRA, thrift savings plan, 401k accounts, and the stock index funds in your taxable accounts.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Okay, here's... Let me go through your seven deadly sins for investors. You said you have inertia listed as number three, but yet you say it's the most powerful force on earth. What do you mean by that?
Well, again, if you're leaving cash in an account earning 0.01% or zero, it feels really good when the market plunges, but you're losing out to inflation year after year after year.
Okay.
So you've got to fight that inertia and have it work well. Again, you can use that inertia to your benefit with a life cycle fund.
Okay.
That'll do the rebalancing for you, and you have to do nothing.
You've listed number one here, and this always surprises me because, you know, from childhood we're taught to be happy, make a happy face, put on a, you know, be happy. And you say optimism is the number one deadly sin. What's that all about?
Well, I'm fascinated why some people are savers and some people are spenders, and there's very little correlation, you know, with our parents. We think we get that from our parents. But what it ends up is that savers are a little bit pessimistic. Optimists are things will take care of themselves. I want that new car. I'm going to go ahead and buy it. I want this vacation. I'm going to go ahead and take it. So pessimists are a little bit more afraid of living under a bridge. And that fear, being afraid, being a little bit pessimistic, has them put money away.
Okay, that's like Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. I'll worry about it tomorrow. So
yeah, exactly. Optimists don't save. I'll have people come to me making, you know, 6-7 figures, saying, I think I'm in good shape for retirement. And when I go through their shoebox of papers, I realize that they have about a $50,000 net worth, and they think they're going to retire next year.
Yeah. Do you have the numbers as to what the average American has saved for retirement? It seems to me I've seen it from time to time, but...
Yeah, I think the median is somewhere around $60,000.
And that's everything.
That's everything. They're going to be living on Social Security and maybe $2,000 or $3,000 a year.
Okay. Alan, Lauren Larson, our producer, is giving me the sign here. We need to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Alan Roth. He is a well-known financial writer, has written for a CBS Money Watch in the past, writes for the Wall Street Journal and also for AARP, which I guess, Alan, may be the largest circulation magazine in the country, huh?
Yeah, I believe it is.
AARP.
At roughly 25 million.
Yeah, I don't think anybody comes close to that. So you get a lot of people. We're talking about the seven deadly sins of investing and a piece you did recently for ARP. And on one hand, you talk about inertia being one of the seven deadly sins. The mirror opposite of that, which you also list, is impulsiveness.
Making an investment decision quickly can often be a mistake. We think we're thinking logically and the like, but Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman, his research, which he won the, his research shows that we have two systems of thinking. System one is kind of our feeling, and system two is our logical. And we may believe that we're thinking very logical and jump out and buy that investment. But if we stop, think about it, discuss it with some trusted friends, and then decide to do it, we're more likely to be making a logical decision.
Okay. You list consumerism as one of the sins. Spending money on the Chinese thing.
I'm sorry, that's keeping up with our neighbors, keeping with the Joneses. My neighbor bought that new luxury car. I've got to buy that new luxury car, maybe even a nicer luxury car, the next model up. That will make me so happy, is the way we think. And it does for a very, very short period of time until we see how much it costs to insure the car, to register the car. We get the first ding on the car, et cetera. And... That sort of thinking tends to take away from our financial future. If we stopped and actually used our system two thinking and realized, my gosh, if I buy that car, it's going to mean I work 1 year longer, we might make a more logical, rational decision.
And that's the basis for a third of the TV commercials we see, too. A guy's doing his lawn, and another fellow drives up with it. He boasts about some silly product, and then his friend has a brand-new Chevrolet or a Ford or something, and that's the basis of that.
I am not what I drive.
Yeah. Another one is trust, which seems odd.
Yeah, we tend to put too much trust in people often, by the way, if they drive a fancy car.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to trust them more, research shows. But we should always trust, whether it's a financial advisor, physician, lawyer, et cetera, enough to listen, but not so much that we follow blindly. And there's research that shows, by the way, if an advisor discloses a conflict of interest, they're actually more likely to abuse the client than less likely. They feel morally licensed to do that.
Because they have fessed up to some extent, huh?
Look, I warned you, Mike, that I make a great commission on this. So you signed it and you bought this annuity.
Okay. All right. Greed and disorder, 6 and 7.
Yeah. Rarely a day goes by. Yesterday, somebody came to me and said, can I look at this investment that gave a safe 6% return? You know, we all want to believe these sorts of things. My common sense answer was, I can look into it. I can call and get more information about it. But boy, if it was a safe 6% return, don't you think institutional money would jump all over that instead of earning, 2% on a bond?
Yeah. The human psyche is fascinating. I heard a discussion on the radio the other day, and I can't remember where I would credit them, but they were talking about charging things versus paying cash. And one person said, an older person said, that people are more careful when they use cash than they are with credit cards. And I would agree with that. I would think that's logical. But a younger, much younger person jumped in, and she said, look, we're young. We're used to credit cards. Sometimes we don't even see cash. So it really doesn't make any difference, and you can't make that assumption for younger people. Do you have any feelings about that?
Yeah, I think that if that younger person had to go to the ATM and get cash, they would get more feedback. There's a piece of our brain known as the insula that's associated with unpleasantness, bitterness, and the more feedback you get on spending money, the more it activates the insula. So yes, absolutely, spending cash rather than charging it on credit card or PayPal gives more feedback and would result in less spending.
It's interesting. I had two friends that were professors at George Washington University, and a couple of times a year they'd have me come in as a guest speaker, you know, talking about the media, journalism. It was the Washington Post at the time. And in order to sort of get these young people out of their comfort zones, I would ask them a number of questions. One of them is, have you been to Europe? And the vast majority raised their hands. Do you have a credit card? The vast majority raised their hands. Are you sitting in George Washington University now? And they all look puzzled and all raised their hands. One of the most expensive schools in America. And my last question was, do you know where the nearest ATM machine is that dispenses money in $5 increments? And you'd see this puzzled look on most people's faces. And usually one person, one student, usually a woman, would get it. And the point is, if you only have $8 in the bank and you desperately need lunch or dinner money, going to an ATM that dispenses in $20 increments won't help you. But and it was interesting. I think that person knew what a buck was worth.
Yeah, and my son just got his first credit card, and I went with him to the bank to get it. And they are telling him that we're going to waive any interest charges for the first 6 months, and we recommend that you pay the minimum. What they were trying to do was essentially train them into mm-hmm. becoming in debt.
Yeah. and you were there. It's funny.
I was there, but he knew better.
Yeah. Well, I have your book in hand, and the book is titled How a Second Grader Beats Wall Street and Golden Rules Any Investor Can Learn. Is that actually your son on the cover?
Yeah, no, it's not.
Okay.
It's
cute
just
little
a
fella.
Picture that Wiley, the publisher, used.
Okay.
The second grader now goes to college next year.
Well, yeah, this little boy on the cover of Alan's book is dressed in a man's suit and clothes and huge shoes, and there are dollar bills, $50 bills, spilling out of his briefcase. But when you wrote this, this was deadly serious, and you had a point, that was that money didn't mean much to him when he had this stock account, correct?
Yeah, he had a huge advantage that he's already losing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, anyone knows you want to buy something when it's on sale.
Yeah.
But, the more money means to us, the more, oh my gosh, the market goes down, a lot of pain. How do we humans make pain stop? We sell it. It's logical. It's rational. But it's not.
So, but the less he cared about money, the better an investor he was. As he grew up and learned how important and wonderful money is, did he get worse?
Well, he lost some of his advantages. In second grade, money meant a candy bar to him. Mm-hmm. Now it means a bit more. He can go out and buy things, but it means more and more to us as we get older, as we build up a nest egg. It's our financial freedom. So the older we get, the more money means to us and the worse investors we get. Because the less human capital we have, years of earning money, and the more investment capital we have. And then that investment capital is between living the way we want to live or living on Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have two friends that one's retired, one's still active. They are builders and on the high-end side of things, and they're pretty progressive guys, and they both have said, I've heard them really talking to each other more than to me, but they both offer 401k plans to their employees, and they both offer a 3% match. And I believe I heard them say that over the years, with all of the come and go and the people, that not one single person has most didn't opt for a 401k. And of those that did, I believe they said nobody took that 3% match. Now, how dumb is that?
Well, it's dumb, but I've heard that story over and over and over again. You know, the sad truth is people would rather have 50 cents today than a dollar tomorrow. They would have much rather have had that raise so they could go out and use consumerism, buy stuff. But passing on that free match is like saying, no, I don't want that money.
Yeah. It's a tax-deferred pay raise.
And even, by the way, if you're going to leave the employer, you're better off getting that match than paying the, if you really do want to spend it, paying the penalty and taxes on it. Just don't miss that match. It's free money.
Well, the Federal Thrift Savings Plan, as you know, for employees who are under the FERS retirement system, which is the vast majority of those working now, will match a total of up to 5% for people who put in 5% or more. Now, that is absolutely huge, and we've had various financial planners on, and some weren't familiar with the TSP, and they couldn't believe that the federal workers and postal employees are eligible for a 5% match. How valuable is that?
Incredibly. Again, there's envy in my voice. Mm-hmm. Very, very few companies do anything close to that.
Yeah.
So not only do you have great options, and by the way, it's not the number of options. I love the fact that the Thrift Savings Plan is simple and broad.
Yeah.
Well, so you've got great options, and you've got great matching.
Well, I recently did actually three columns in a short time frame showing the number of people who had $1 million accounts. I think there's over 3,000 or 4,000. One person had, I believe, 4.3 million. But the number in the $500,000 range was huge. And it's a testimony to how smart federal workers are and how well this Thrift Savings Plan program has been advertised and sold to them, but it's also a tribute to that 5% match, isn't it?
Yeah. And again, inertia can be a force for good as well. Learning to live below your means, putting that money away, getting the match, keeping fees incredibly low, not trying to time the market, it works. It's boring as heck, but it works.
Yeah, the first questioner we had, Michael from Arlington, he was talking about trading. He had to trade by noon in order for it to take effect at 4 p.m. I mean, that's day trading, correct?
Absolutely. And by the way, I wrote a piece for AARP not too long ago. Women make better investors than men.
I saw that. Yeah, I ran that by a number of people, and they all said they didn't have any factual proof, but that was their feeling. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, there was a study by Odin and Barber. You know, boys will be boys, and what they did is they looked at investment accounts of men versus women, thousands and thousands, and men tended to trade more, and that trading ended up having lower returns. And a lot of it is due to overconfidence that we men have.
Yeah, in our own abilities. Then.
Exactly. Okay. What profession do you think makes the worst investors? I never take on a physician client without telling them that overconfidence.
Interesting. So the brain surgeon may be a terrible investor, huh?
Yeah, they've beaten the odds. They've gotten through med school, residency. They're treated almost as gods. You know, reservation for Dr. Roth, and that tends to lead to overconfidence, which is one of the most, you know,
listen, hold
disadvantages of investing.
Hold that thought, and we'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Alan Roth. He is a columnist for the AARP and writes for the Wall Street Journal. Alan, you said interesting stuff before the break. We were talking about investors as a breed, and you said that you felt, and I remember reading your column, that women are better investors than men.
Yeah, again, it's less overconfidence. Men tend to have more overconfidence, probably related to testosterone, mm-hmm. which makes us believe that we know what the market's going to do. We know what the three best stocks are. And that trading is incredibly correlated to lower returns. And there was a fairly major study going through thousands of statements that, you know, showed that statistically men were worse investors.
That's so interesting. And you said that possibly your worst clients would be physicians, simply because the what they've been through and in order to become doctors.
Yeah, that they've beaten the odds. They've gotten into med school. Mm-hmm. They've lived through the slave labor residency. Mm-hmm. They're high income earners. They're treated almost as gods. Yeah. Again, they're the only profession that are referred to as doctors. You don't call me high Alan Roth, yeah. CPA, MBA.
Yeah.
And that tends to lead to overconfidence. And I see some doctors just make dumb mistakes over and over and over and over again.
I was in the Washington.
There are also some incredibly brilliant doctors. Yeah. William Bernstein, the writer and physician, is brilliant.
Yeah, Charles Krauthammer is a psychiatrist, I believe, the columnist. I was in the hospital some years ago, and I was treated like a king, and I didn't quite get it. I thought maybe it was my scintillating personality, but when I checked out, I noticed they had the patients listed on the board outside, and they had me down as Dr. Causey. I would recommend, if you ever are admitted to a hospital, tell them you're a doctor. Can't hurt.
Got it.
You know, when you mentioned the male overconfidence and ego thing, I remember I knew someone, and she said that her husband, or her late husband, used to call him when he was in important meetings. He was with the city government, and he would sometimes be chairing it because he was in the Parks and Recreation Department. But she would call and just make idle talk, and he would talk back to her as if she were his stockbroker. And she figured this was his ego. He wanted these fellow civil servants to think he was a player.
Ah, okay.
So you recently wrote a column. Headline is, "When will the stock market return to normal?" And I guess everybody's saying that we had the recession. It's coming back. But when is it going to return to normal?
Yeah, people were asking me that about a month ago when, stocks were down 10-11%. We were entering, close to bear territory. And my answer was, it already has. It was the 6 years before that, from 2009, we're still technically in this bull market. Stocks have gone straight up without a correction. And even though we believe volatility is higher, until this year, we've had 6 years of below average volatility. So, the fact that the market is going to go up with lower than average volatility, forever is not going to happen. So what happened so far in the first couple of months is that it returned to normal.
Well, and I guess
feel like it.
I guess one of the best things that someone could do is with the crash in 2007, 2008 to the 2009, I think the market hit bottom. But so many people in the Federal Thrift Savings Plan put all their money in the G fund at about that time. So they took it out of stocks and stopped buying stocks when they were, as it turns out, on sale.
Yeah, absolutely. I've written on that. Advisors did the same thing. Mm-hmm. And, I'm very proud on my website, 2 days before the market bottomed in 2009, I'm saying stocks are on sale. Why aren't people buying? But, if you ever watch that interview, know that my inner voice is going, please, please, please let me be right.
Yeah,
it was a scary time. It was hard to do.
It really was. I know a Fed, she had a very large TSP account, and she finally said, I can't stand it any longer. I know it's probably wrong, but I'm going to the G fund. And I don't know if she continued to buy stocks. Hope she did. But if she didn't, she lost a ton of money.
Yeah, and my advice to people, by the way, if they did panic and sell in 08 and 09, they probably shouldn't be in stocks because that's the best predictor of what they'll do the next time stocks plunge.
Right. Lessons learned, but you don't apply them in the future. Alan, tell me how you work. You're based in Colorado Springs?
Yeah, Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Okay.
I'm kind of an oddball. I'm strictly hourly, and you know that might be one reason. You know, most advisors are percentage of assets. Why I, you know, would not recommend people close their thrift savings plan, because many advisors profit from capturing the funds. But yeah, I'm strictly an hourly advisor and, you know, writer. I've gotten to be fairly expensive, so, you know, I'm not particularly proud of it, but I tend to help very, you know, wealthier clients. Mm-hmm.
Well, I wonder why so many publications ask you to write things, because so many financial planners, and this is the way they do it, but they do handle stocks and mutual funds and whatnot, and naturally they like them or they wouldn't handle them, I guess, but they get a percentage out of that. But you're strictly, I come into you, we chat and pay you on an hourly basis.
Yeah, I'm fee for service like every other profession on the planet. Just like doctors, lawyers, accountants. The only thing I sell is advice.
Good deal. Well, what have you written recently? That one about when the stock market will return to normal. That was February 17th. So you were exactly right. You were right on the money, because we had been coming off an incredibly good binge, and a lot of people didn't notice it.
Yeah, you know what I've written recently was, you know, index funds are even better than you think. You know, Morningstar, we've all seen how index funds do versus the active fund, but many active funds go out of business. It's called survivorship bias, and Morningstar was able to adjust for that, which I think is absolutely amazing.
I love that term, survivorship bias.
Yeah, we're only comparing the index funds to the to the funds that didn't go out of business over the last 10 years, but many did.
Okay. Well, somebody starting out in government, they're 25, 26. They don't know, I guess nobody knows where their career is going to take them these days. In the old days, a lot of people, I think 30%, actually retired from the government. Now, I don't know whether that has changed. But what advice would you give them about the thrift savings plan? Do it.
Start early. Get the match. Probably a life cycle fund. Harness that power of inertia. It's boring. You know, resist your instincts. And don't let anyone talk you into rolling it over to an IRA if you leave the government.
Okay. Yeah. That and which is what many, if not most, people do now.
Yeah. And again, a lot of advisors profit from getting, you know, government retirees to move money out of the thrift savings plan.
Oh, sure, they do. They do in a variety of ways. Now, the financial community has been looking at the TSP with lust in its eyes since it began, because the huge numbers of people in it, the fact that the government does all the work, the government makes the deductions and does that, and the administrative fees are so low. And a lot of financial planners, if they could get a hold of a government worker after they've left the government or after they've retired, that would be a great client base.
Yeah, it would. And lots of advisors target federal employees after they retire.
Now, over the years, there hasn't been much lately. The recession kind of put an end to this. But for many years, there was tremendous pressure on the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board. Those are the people that run the TSP. But there was tremendous pressure on the board to open it up, to bring in more investment options. And one of them was the real estate industry, as everybody knows, is very powerful. And they wanted to have a mutual fund in the TSP that was made up of REITs, real estate investment trusts, which at the time were doing very good. The others wanted precious metal funds. Some wanted strictly a gold or platinum fund. There was pressure put on for a dot-com only fund. And, you know, you name it, socially conscious, a variety of things. They didn't allow any of them in. Do you think that was a good thing?
Yes. Again, it's not the number of funds. And notice that there's a pattern there. People want a fund after it has done well. And don't forget, you know, a Total U.S. and Total International will own REITs. It will own the precious metals and mining funds. You know, it is broadly diversified. People will want whatever has performed well. And then there's more research that shows that when somebody is presented, 60 different options in their 401k, that they have too much data and they tend to just leave it in cash.
I've seen that in operation with people. There's just too many choices. Listen, take a short break here. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Alan Roth. He's a financial planner based in Colorado Springs, and he works on an hourly basis. Alan, how could people reach you?
My domain name, believe it or not, is, as I'm sure you know, is daretobedull.com.
Daretobedull.com. Yeah. In fact, that's how we met, because I was using it somewhere or other, and we got in touch, and you said, actually, it's mine, but go ahead, but it is your domain name, daretobedull.com. That's good. Alan, you said to ask you about market adages. What's the deal with this?
Yeah, a piece I wrote not too long ago was just examining, you know, certain sayings like don't fight the Fed. You know, if the Fed is raising rates, that means interest rates are going to go up, the market is going to go down. And, you know, that one ends up being false. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, the Fed raised rates, and that's, you know, the overnight rate, and intermediate long-term interest rates actually fell. And there's a lot of data that shows that it's not a reliable forecaster of what stocks are going to do.
Okay. And what other things have we been leading us astray?
The trend is your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that, you know, if something is moving up, you want to buy it. If it's moving down, you want to sell it. And you know, that's known as momentum investing, and also is a good formula for buying high and selling low. There is some data that shows in the very short run, something that has gone up is likely to continue to go up. But when it goes down, it is really going to go down. You know, let's just look at 2007. Stocks were up for 5 straight years, U.S. stocks doubled, international stocks tripled, and suddenly in 2008, mainly in 1 month, October, stocks plunged. The trend was not your friend.
Well, I guess the lesson here is that, boy, by the time Wall Street has figured it out and is doing it, it's a little late for us. Also runs, and was thinking the other day coming to work, there was on our sister station WTOP, they were talking about the merger between two hotel giants, and I think one of them is going to be the first American hotel to go into Havana in a long time. But and I was thinking to myself, those two, both good outfits, one local, and it would be a good time to buy their stock. And I thought, well, probably some wiser heads than mine have already figured this out.
Yeah, exactly. If you've read about it,
yeah.
If you've heard it on the news, it's
out
late.
There. Yeah.
If you're going to beat the market, you have to know something that the rest of the market doesn't know about. And maybe you are one of the few subscribers to a newsletter. But again, if the writer of the newsletter really knew what a stock was going to do, would they really be writing a newsletter?
Right. They're not going to tip you off, and they wouldn't be making their income from the newsletter fees. They would be making their income from the market.
Yeah, I wouldn't be working and writing for a living if I knew what the market was going to do next month.
Yeah. You got any sort of parting thoughts for people, in particularly those in the thrift savings plan?
Yeah. You've got a wonderful asset there. It is incredibly boring, and that is a wonderful thing.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's what you...
Put money away early, you know, often. It's an easier problem to solve. I have too much money. What do I do now? Then I don't have enough money. What do I do now?
Well, you said, I mean, dare to be dull. That's the whole philosophy, is that investing what should not be exciting.
Yeah, it should be incredibly boring. If you're getting pleasure out of investing, you're probably doing it wrong. And quite frankly, you know, pain is a wonderful sign. You know, buying stocks in March 9th of 2009 was enough to make me vomit. Mm-hmm. It hurt like heck, and that is a wonderful sign.
March 9, 2009, was that the bottom?
Yeah, that was the day the market bottomed, and I remember that because it's also the day my book came out. Excellent. What timing.
Excellent. Good. Okay. I hear from people from time to time, and they take your advice about the life cycle funds, the target date funds, up to a point. But for instance, they'll say, I have 10% in the S fund, 10 in the C fund, 10 in the I fund, and then the rest in the 2030 fund. Are they working against themselves?
Oh, you know, it's hard to say. Again, I don't have target date retirement funds because I do the asset location. I prefer to have it more tax efficient. So it's hard to say.
Okay.
You know, I'd have to look at each case, you know, individually. You know, oftentimes for federal employees, I have them put everything in the G fund because I'm having them take their risk in their taxable portfolio.
I see. Explain that again, because you said that earlier, and my eyes kind of glazed over.
Yeah, you know, stock index funds are incredibly tax efficient. You know, because the dividends are taxed at the 15% rate, and the capital gains you get to defer for forever. So you're better off if, let's say, you were going to be a 60-40 portfolio, you'd be better off having your stock index funds in your taxable account. And then your fixed income, things that are taxed at the highest rates in your tax-deferred accounts, your IRA or thrift savings plan. And because the G fund, you know, not only does the thrift savings plan have lower cost, but the G fund gives you an intermediate term rate without any interest rate risk. You know, with the F fund, if rates go up, the bond fund will go down, the G fund won't. So because that is such a superior fund and it's the ideal place for the location, you know, we could have you putting your 60% in stocks if you had enough in your taxable account in a total U.S. and total international index fund and your fixed income in the G fund.
Well,
that's a complex.
I don't know this for a fact, but I would bet that many, if not most, federal investors don't have outside investments, that the TSP is it for them. Does that still apply?
No, if the TSP is it for them, then a target date retirement fund, the life cycle fund, is probably ideal.
Perfect. Thank you, Alan Roth. We're going to have you back here real soon. And thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you here next Wednesday, I hope.
Thanks so much.